just tell me straight before I have to go. Oh, oh, I wanna know.
Hi, everybody. This is Chantel Lopez. Welcome to another Thinking Pilates podcast. This is episode 30, and today we are joined with someone who I consider a very dear friend and an exceptional colleague. Her name is Anna Hartman. Hi, Anna.
Hi there.
So we have kind of an interesting history, and we're going to get into that just a little bit because it's very sweet and really fun, I think, just to share how we got to know each other and how we first found out about each other. But one of the reasons why I wanted to bring Anna onto the podcast is because she and I have been having some really interesting conversations over the last few years. And Anna is often the person that I go to when I have really geeky, really technical questions about the body. And whether that's in a grotesquely long email, or it's a quick text message, or it's over lunch when she's here in California, it's really been so super valuable to me. And we've talked about so much great stuff that I thought it would be good to share what we've been jamming around. So, Anna, you are in Scottsdale, Arizona, and you've been an athletic trainer, kind of at the foundation of your work for how many years now?
I've been an athletic trainer for 14 years.
Awesome. And Anna and I actually met kind of circuitously through a friend, my friend Corey Martinez here in Sacramento. And how did it actually all happen, Anna? Like, how did we find out about each other?
Well, yeah. So I met Corey while I was in Sacramento taking care of my mom, and just walked into Asha and knew it was like the place I needed to be. And then eventually met Corey and became obsessed with her because she was the first yoga teacher that I had ever experienced yoga movement from through the sort of, I say, more of like the Pilates eyes or like just movement science background. And I had always known I wanted to do a yoga teacher training, but that was sort of my limitation, was like, I want to make sure it's somebody who really understands the body and movement. And so I got to know her, and she kept on telling me, oh, you need to meet my friend Chantel. You'll love her. You guys are like you guys are totally going to nerd out. And and I was like, oh, I've heard that name before from, you know, other people. So kind of like the Pilates world. And then we finally, I think the first time we connected it might've been teacher training 2 years ago in Hawaii.
I think that's the first
which
time.
Is funny. Oh, cause she, I know how it was, because I felt like I already knew you, but
yes,
cause she recommended your book to me.
Yeah.
And your book ended up being like a huge tipping point for me to leave the company that I was working for 11 years and start out on my own and doing my own thing. And so I was like so grateful for that book, and was like telling everybody, regardless of whether they were a Pilates or movement practitioner or, you know, at all, that they needed to do it. And so we got connected that way first and kind of became friends over email and social media, and then finally met in person 2 years ago, almost to the day.
You're right. It was October. I just remember having this really, interesting experience, which I think is not totally foreign to people these days, which is, you know, I think the first time we actually exchanged a direct communication was on Facebook, around the book. I don't really remember what it was, something maybe Corey posted. And then just like instantly for me, like just instantly knowing that, you know, like we were going to be friends and how sweet it was already. And we had this kind of thing, you know, friendship happening via social media. And then teacher training was coming up in Hawaii. And I just remember the moment that Corey told me that you were going to be there. I was like, no way. I get to finally meet her. That's crazy. So, it was so cool. It was so cool. I also remember, driving up to the farm, where we were hosting the teacher training, and you guys had already been there, right? Mm-hmm. You had already been there for a week, and I walking down the driveway, and then just the first time that we met was really just so sweet. And then I think it was just like, it was just kind of all over from there. And, of course we had it.
Then we couldn't stop talking, even though it was, we have silence.
Yes. We were supposed to be in silence. We were maybe not very good about that. But it's been, you know, it's been such a pleasure to have somebody who's so thoughtful and so knowledgeable about the body to really turn to, who kind of gets both perspectives. And I think that's something unique that you bring to the work that you do and the work that you're influencing, whether it's, you know, Pilates teachers, or other athletic trainers or people in the yoga community. It's a real, real high quality thoughtfulness. And I appreciate that about you so much. And I feel like you live by something that I hold really dear, which is this idea of like not making a rule of things, just being, being very open and being very flexible and putting your knowledge to work in all kinds of different ways, never getting, kind of pigeonholed into one approach, or being totally married to an idea. And, I've just always really valued that about you. And it stands out in our conversations, which leads me to, we have had some recent conversations about some high areas of interest for me, and things that I have been working on with my teachers through skillful teaching. And one of them has been verbal cueing and manual cueing. And we've had all kinds of discussions about this, and I want to talk a bit about some of those things, because they're worth it. But what I want to do a little bit is also kind of, start at the end and work ourselves backwards a little bit, or maybe just, preface this idea. The last time we were talking, we both decided we should have recorded the conversation because it was like awesome, awesome. Totally great, exchange of ideas and questions and insights and all of this just really cool stuff. And of course we didn't record it. But one of the things, in my notes was just about what you brought to the table, which is this idea of, resilience and, positive or appropriate compensation in the body, and how what happens a lot of times for us as teachers is that we get very, very attached to the idea of achieving perfect movement for our students without really understanding the implications of that. And I think a lot of what we have talked about over the course of the last couple of years really all lends itself to that one overarching idea.
So absolutely.
Yeah. That's where I'm hoping we'll go. I'm hoping that we're going to get there. Well, here's the thing. We can just start there. So just let's talk about this. What does this mean to you? So you're working with high-level athletes primarily. Is that true?
Yes, that is absolutely true.
And you are also a master-level Pilates teacher through Polestar.
Yes, I did my Polestar comprehensive. I think I finished it in 2011. Mm-hmm. And before that, I went to, I think I've been to every rehab summit Pilates on Tour that Balanced Bodies put on down here in Phoenix since it started, and so my experience with Pilates really was that, and then through just taking classes on my own. And my first ever Pilates on Tour, I was introduced to Elizabeth Larkham, and it was again like somebody else that I became obsessed with. And really it was like the first, oh my gosh, maybe people who are movement practitioners know something and have something to share and offer me and teach me. And so it was, especially coming from a rehab and physical therapy world, sports medicine world, you kind of assume that because you have this license or this, you know, specialized degree that you know everything. Also, I'm sure because I was really young, and so I thought I knew everything. And I remember learning from Elizabeth and being like, oh my gosh, not only was I blown away, but I was like, I'm pretty sure she's spoken a completely different language. And so I was like, I pretty much then followed her and became her shadow for however many years after, and became friends with her. And so that was sort of my entry, was Elizabeth Larcom style contemporary Pilates. Mm-hmm. And then went into the Polestar from there, wanting it to be sort of more from a rehab standpoint. Mm-hmm. And that's it. Yes. So that's my Pilates background.
Yeah. And so what about this idea of creating, like, how does this make sense to you from where you're coming from and the work that you do, in terms of not necessarily having the goal be perfect movement, but about really preparing the body for appropriate and resilient compensation? Like, what is that all about?
Right. It's sort of been like a long time developing my thoughts around that, you know, and I've come full circle in terms of, thinking, you know, the way to improve performance and make people be pain-free is to completely clean up their movement and make movement patterns perfect and move perfectly. And it was better to move slowly and perfectly than quickly without good movement patterns. And, you know, and especially this era in the physical therapy and sports medicine research really supports that. Mm-hmm. And, so it's easy to get roped into that way of thinking. Mm-hmm. But in the background always was the knowledge, especially with working with the professional athletes, like elite level athletes, is we'd get these amazing athletes that came into the doors of our facility, and they were really poor movers, but yet a lot of them didn't have a huge injury history, and they were like performing at the peak. And so there's always that kind of like question in the back of my mind, and in terms of like, if we're saying that people's movement patterns need to be perfect in order for them to perform at a certain level and to feel healthy and be, you know, have a good life and have a good performance, like, then why are these athletes like such poor movers? Like, it wasn't like equaling it. Uh-huh. But in my head, I was like, well, you know, but we can make them better. Maybe they could even be more like, they're already amazing. They could be more amazing. And uh-huh. So let's just clean up their movement. And some of them did obviously have very good results, but then other ones, they didn't necessarily have the best results. And so it's always like, you know, I'm a huge thinker. And so I'm constantly like thinking like, well, why? And like, why does this work? And why does this not work? And are we really doing what we think we're doing by applying whatever exercise or modality? And so, it was not until the last few years that I was introduced to both Philip Beach's work with his contractile field theory and, mm-hmm. Jean-Pierre Barral, who is the founder of the Barral Institute, through his work with of visceral manipulation and neural manipulation, which is more of an osteopathic type perspective, that I started to realize, like, maybe this is the answer. Maybe, movement is important to a point, but the reason we have injury, the reason we get hurt or don't feel well, is that we've actually lost the ability to compensate. And that's what I've always known the athletes were really good at, was better than any normal person I've ever trained or better than myself, their ability to have things like have all these stresses loaded upon them. Their ability to compensate and keep going at a high level is so much greater than normal people. Mm. That's really what sets them apart. And so when the teachers at the Barral Institute shared that quote or that information from Jean-Pierre, it was like, oh my gosh, that's it. You know, hit one of his quotes he uses, which may or may not be his, but it's some osteopaths in Europe, is, you know, that's what disease is, that it's not that, compensation is not bad, but it's the ability to when you lose the ability to compensate is when disease happens. Mm-hmm. And so that really was like, okay, this is a completely different perspective. And so that really, with that and Philip's stuff, was just really this huge change in what I did to sort of take a lot of the thinking of movement out and stop like almost paralyzing people from being able to move because they're worried something's going to hurt if they move wrong.
Yeah.
To making things like way more simple. Like we have a tendency to make things super complicated and I don't really think it has to be.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so it's interesting because, you know, Philip's work, you know, really roots back to the evolutionary development of human beings and looking at like how we used to move, right? More animalistically, you know, as hunter gatherers and, you know, being able to get up and get down from the ground in a myriad of ways. That is not, you know, always like ergonomically beautiful, or, right. you know, or perfect. And then it reminds me too about, have you heard of, I don't know if it's Edo Portal or Ido Portal.
Yeah.
Do you know that guy?
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things that's so cool about him, I think one of the coolest things I've ever heard him say is that it's not about, you know, perfect posture. It's really just about, you need to be able to be out of alignment, right? Being in alignment right. is easy, but you need to be able to be adaptable, morphable enough that you can be out of alignment and still be healthy and still function with ease and efficiency. And I think, you know, that's one of the things that I love so much just about kind of where you see a lot of practitioners going now. You know, Philip's work has had a huge impact on that specific way of thinking about movement and system health, right? Because it's not just about movement. It's not just about muscles, not just about fascia, but it's about the organs. It's about the neurology. It's about, you know, all of the pieces functioning well together. And it's really, as a Pilates professional, it's really quite a relief to feel like, there is potentially a lot more value in, you know, that sense of adaptability and being out of alignment and not feeling like it has to just, be one way or be perfect all of the time, which of course I think that there is value. And I think that you would agree, you know, inconsistency and in like doing the work and doing the work well, like we don't want sloppy movement necessarily. Right. So,
right. It still has to be awareness. Like in order to make any changes, you still have to be aware. And so I'm not saying just to go crazy, but I'm saying that perhaps it doesn't matter so much to be directing the muscles. Like perhaps when we're directing the muscles, we're actually not helping. We're actually hurting people's movement.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, talk about that more when we're directing the muscles, talk about that versus.
Yeah. There's so many things in my head I want to talk about. I'll talk about that, but just to throw it out there so I don't lose thought, maybe it's on your mind too, but I wanted to go back to like Ido Portal's work and Philip's work and like why I think that they have brought so much to movement and how they relate to resiliency and sort of more of like the definition of resiliency.
Yeah,
but we can go back to that.
Well, no, let's go there now because I think that'll finish off the original thought and then we'll talk about what it means to just train the muscles.
Yeah, the muscles. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of like you said in the beginning too, of like, you know, when you first talked to me, what you liked is I have this, for whatever reason, I think, cause I am a thinker, everything I've ever learned and every person I've ever been around, or in every experience I've had in my own body, that has had a lot of injuries. I constantly am like assimilating all the information in my head and I'm constantly trying to, you know, cause I really really believe, like, there's no new information out there. Everybody's really saying the same thing, just in different ways, and it's going to come back generation after generation, and the things that really work get filtered out.
Right.
And if you really listen to people, they really are saying all the same things. And so, which is great, right? Because then it's like you can follow anybody and make improvements. And so one of the things, one of my first mentors, Mark Versagen, who is the founder and owner of Athletes Performance, now Exos, where I worked, one of his mantras was work plus rest equals success. And, you know, it has a nice ring to it. And especially with athletes, again, like we knew, they know work. Like, no doubt that someone at that level and has achieved that much, like, they know how to work. Mm-hmm. I don't have to tell them to work or how to work. Mm-hmm. But if I only have a week with them or 2 weeks with them, the place I'm going to make more, you know, the most bang for my buck is the rest, because most people don't know how to rest very well. Mm-hmm. And so if I'm going to really affect that equation, like, yes, I can teach them how to work smarter and work better in terms of improving their movement patterns. But if I can teach them some skills, some ways to rest better, now we're talking about huge gains on their performance and success. Mm-hmm. And I really think that that's what a lot of the new trendier movement things bring to the table, is that rest piece. And why yoga and Pilates has been so successful for people is the rest piece. And not meaning like you're not doing anything rest, but really what the body recognizes as rest in terms of more of like the nervous system. You know, we're constantly in a fight or flight, a sympathetic nervous system dominant pattern of stress in our life, whether it's real stress or manufactured stress, emotional stress or physical stress, we all have a lot of it. And most of us don't do the things that tell our body that we're not stressed anymore, that it's okay to rest. Mm-hmm. It's okay to let our guard down. So our hormones and our biochemistry and all the little amazingly intelligent parts of our cells can do their work in creating balance and homeostasis in the body, so the body can actually heal itself and express its resiliency. So the resiliency, you know, the definition of it is for a structure to be, or structure or something, to be able to have a ton of stress applied to it, and but when the stress is removed, for it to be able to bounce back to its original shape.
Right.
Which is also, if you follow fascial fitness craze, the definition of tensegrity and the fascial network, right?
Right.
And so, so it's like, man, this is where the movement is really powerful in order to do that. But then also, it's where the breath piece comes in. And not only the breath piece, but the last piece of it is where going back to moving on the floor and getting up from the floor is so important.
Yeah.
And that's what yoga has always done and Pilates has always done, whether you knew it was actually a really powerful part of it or not, but it's actually being on the floor.
Right.
And stimulating certain, more than likely, you know, there's, nobody knows why the floor creates that trigger for our body to know it's resting, except there is, if you follow the work of Pavel Kolaj and Vladimir Yanda and Carl Lewitt from the Prague School of Rehabilitation Practitioners in the Czech Republic, they use this manual therapy for developmental problems within youth called reflexive locomotion. And there's certain points on the body, reflexive points that you can stimulate on the body that stimulates the neural patterning of crawling and walking and breathing and breathing in a three-dimensional, like very restful state. And that's my thought process, again, like assimilating all this information, is like perhaps when we're on the floor, just like a baby, when they learn to crawl, when they're on the floor, those pressure points are getting stimulated more than when you're on furniture. And so when those pressure points are stimulated, those are the points of the body that are intelligent enough to know, oh, we're on the floor, we're resting. We can change our entire neurological and chemical system to reflect now that we're not stressed out. And so I mean, I think that's like that, you know, I'm, like I said, I'm always questioning, is what we're doing really what we're like, is what we're doing, why it's working? Is it, it's, is it really doing what we think it's doing?
Yeah.
So the Pilates has been known for so long, you know, and the rehab industry is great core stability. Well, unfortunately, if you look at a lot of the peer reviewed journal articles, it's really hard to come to a consensus on number one, what core stability is.
Is.
Uh-huh. And number two, how to measure it. And number three, does it even really exist? And so that means, like, is then Pilates really doing that? Because maybe not. And maybe the value is that it's helping people rest better. And part of when the body's resting better, it naturally improves mobility and stability and function because it becomes more resilient and it rebounds to its original shape.
Interesting.
So
what do you mean by does core stability even exist? Like as an idea or in the way that we have been thinking about it or?
Both, I guess. Like I don't even, if, most of the time, like if you were to come to one of my workshops or if you were my client, I would not ever mention, you wouldn't hear me talk about core stability at all. Mm-hmm. You'd hear me talk about movement efficiency, or just movement economy, like how much your movement is costing you.
Right.
From an energy standpoint and, which is like from an efficiency standpoint, and you're either efficient or you're not efficient. And right. When you're efficient, you have that dynamic alignment, like you were talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you not only have dynamic alignment, but you have quick reaction time. You burn calories more efficiently. Like everything is just efficient. So to me, like the way most people would describe core stability, I describe as efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because you know, I'm kind of with Philip Beach. Like if you look at the anatomy, like where's the core?
Yeah.
Like what's the core? Like, and if you want to pick out structures, then you can pick out structures that people think are the core but are not really the core. And I think to me, like if I had to really pick, if somebody like was holding a gun to my head and said, Anna, you need to pick a core, like what do you think the core is? What do you think is then the foundation or the most important part of the body? I'd say the most important part of the body as a human organism is the organs.
Uh-huh.
Period. End of statement. It's the organs. And so if the organs aren't functioning and are not happy, then everything else goes into protection mode to take care of them.
Right.
And also in the sense of core stability, if you're saying having good core stability helps you maintain quote unquote good posture,
mm-hmm.
then I'd say it's the fascia, because without our fascia, we have no shape.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And well, without our fascial system, we are a blob of skin and bones and liquid and organs on floor.
And very little ability to even communicate. Without the fascial system transduce energy and to dissipate load and all of the things that are necessary for being in space.
Yes. And it's just like, to me, it's like everything is so integrated that you can't have one without the other, that it's like, how do you pick something and call it the core or call it like the number one thing that you have to have? No, you have to have a body that works,
mm-hmm.
and feels good.
Mm-hmm.
And because when you have a body that works and feels good, you want to move because it's fun.
Yeah.
You have, like, just like Joseph Pilates said, you have that zest for life. Like it comes back. Like the more in tune you are and the more connected you are to your fashion, the more resilient you are. Like no joke. Like I have had moments in the last few months that I've been running. First of all, I've always hated running, mm-hmm. but I hate running because it hurts.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm running and it doesn't hurt. And I have flashes of being in the first grade again, mm-hmm. and like hearing the recess bell and like being so excited to go out and run towards the monkey bars to go play. Right. Like, it's just this, like when it's all in tune, you treat it all as one thing instead of a reductionist view of parts.
Yeah.
I just think it's so much more simple and it's so much more enjoyable. It doesn't feel like work anymore.
Yeah.
It's something that you want to do. Go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking like the bottom line too, from the teaching perspective or the coaching or training perspective, is that when we do approach movement from this perspective of isolating pieces, it's hard to learn. It's not just hard, but sometimes it's impossible to, hard to learn and impossible to integrate, because we're not talking about integration at all. We're just reducing the body to into pieces. And then the brain of the student, there's really no way for them to integrate that information, let alone fully translate that into the felt sense of how the body, you know, could move more beneficially. There's like, it's one example of that, I think, that we've talked about is just the difference between internal and external cueing, right? And the way we can just be way, way too complex with the way that we're actually teaching movement or encouraging movement. I was just thinking about a couple of other things as you were talking. I mean, you said in terms of like the, you know, is there even core stability? Is there even a core, you know, it's like, it's so interesting, but it does make me think of two things in particular. And one is, again, this kind of holistic approach to the system functionality, right? Whole system functionality. It's not about, I think one of the things that I have strayed away from a lot in my own teaching is, you know, engage the abdominals and then move. It's like that kind of organization, like explicit, like I'm going to tell my core to engage and then it's going to engage and then I'm going to think about the next movement, is so counter to what we're actually trying to get to happen that, you know, it's
right.
So this idea that it's all connected. So why don't we just connect it all in our movement training? You know, because things like the pelvic floor and the TA and the multifidi, they're all supposed to turn on before you're even thinking about it anyway. So does it make sense for us to say, okay, take an inhale, exhale, engage that muscle, think about it, locate it, sense it, engage it if you can, to the appropriate degree for the appropriate length of time, and now just at the right moment, move the legs and like do all of these things. Like there's just, how is that ever going to really, I mean, obviously it offers value and benefit, right? We all feel better when we're moving thoughtfully. You know, this is not to devalue all the work that we do, but
oh no,
I mean, just to give it some, so from my perspective to think that's how that idea of like, well, what is the core? And is there really even a core, an isolated specific one thing that we can call the core? Is there anything really, is core stability a thing, or is it just an idea that we've come up with to make it easier, you know,
right,
or, you know, for perpetuating the, you know, a method of movement or whatever it might be.
Right.
And then the other thing is just what Philip, I remember, when I took my first workshop with Philip, he said, don't be a tissue fascist. Like this is not about, you know, and it's not surprising. All of us are coming from the, you know, at that point from the Thomas Myers model where, you know, and then all of the, you know, the burgeoning, not just burgeoning, but like the influx of research around fascia and fascial oriented training, you know, we're so kind of narrowly focused on that being the thing, but his idea, you know, and the contractile fields, man, they really just mess us all up because they're not isolated to one tissue type and they're not isolated to one system in the body. They're totally integrated. Which makes me also think like, there is just no core, right? There's no, I mean, it's an illusion. You know, it's an oversimplification of, you know, how we can teach an idea. But maybe it's that we've gone too far in that direction. And now it's now, as you said before, it's like, are we really doing what we think we're doing? I mean, we've been working with such an oversimplified, you know, idea or tool, for so long that it's just, you know, now we've just shot ourselves in the foot a little bit.
Right. And I mean, I'm with you too. It's like, man, like I got really good results with my clients for years before I had these opinions. It's not that we're doing something wrong. It's just, you know, I like to know the whys. And so I'm, you know, again, it's like going back to like, if I'm doing the 100 with someone, like, what am I really doing? Like, mm-hmm. what is the value of it? Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. And because then for me, when I'm sequencing programming, then I have a different reason to put it somewhere than what I thought previously.
Right.
And so then it's like, because, you know, most people don't want to train their body for 3 hours a day, like the athletes, right? They want to do as much as needed, but as little as possible to feel good. Like, we just want to feel good. I don't like to train. I worked in a, you know, basically a gym for 11 years. If I never lift a weight again in my life, I would be thrilled.
Yeah.
But it's honestly, it's never been what's made me tick in the first place.
Yeah.
I did gymnastics. I like to move my body. And so what's the rule saying that I have to all of a sudden use all these added masses to get a certain job done and make my body feel good? And mm-hmm. it's like, I don't agree. Uh-huh. Did I get some good results at one time with weights? Of course I did. Mm-hmm. But did it require a lot of work? Absolutely. It required a gym. It required a lot of time, like more time than I spend on my body now. And I don't think I actually felt as good as I do now. And so to me, that's what I want. I want to just feel good and then be able to do whatever I want with my day instead of worrying about getting my hour and a half to 3 hours in the gym. Yeah. But if somebody loves, like, people love the gym. People love that. If that's what you love to do, then go do it. I'm not saying it's bad for you, but it's not what I want to do. And so I always tease people. It's like, oh, like, I am 100% understand that all the knowledge I gain in the to make my athletes do better is just a false, like, I'm totally lying to them when I say that, because at the end of the day, it's always about me. Like, how do I make myself feel better mm-hmm. in my own body? And so everything is sort of like, I'm always seeking new ideas and seeking answers based on myself. But if anybody really deep down thinks about it, that's why I do it too. Sure. And like, even helping people, I help people because it makes me feel good.
Yeah. Oh, your exposure to Corey is coming through.
Yes, exactly.
I just keep thinking Byron Katie, Byron Katie. This is exactly what Byron Katie is talking about. You know, we're all this is going to maybe just appall some people, but you know, we're just all inherently selfish. Like, we're driven by what makes us feel good. And the truth is, we do a lot of good from that perspective, right? Just like what you're saying, we're driven to help people because it makes us feel good, because we feel like we're adding value to the world. But that's all about us. That's not about somebody else.
It's not about the world, and it's not about us. Well, but knowing, you know, and then it goes, well, and this, I just had this conversation today about, with my friend, you know, and again, it goes back to like the tissue fascist thing. It's like, we are a human organism. Which includes not only the body and everything in the body, but the mind and the spirit.
Yes.
Like, mm-hmm. the emotions are part of, like, you can't take the psychology out of it. You Absolutely. Can't take the spiritual stuff out of it. And mm-hmm. so the minute you try to, you're missing the boat. And, and again, like, not everybody likes to be so focused on their body. We are all in an industry that we like to focus on our body, which is fine. But you can get similar, if not better, results focusing on the mind and the spiritual stuff too. And people do. Like, how many times do you hear somebody like, meditation changed my life? Meditation, I meditated and I lost 60 pounds. Yeah. And I went from not being able to run to loving running. Or I, you know, found God or whatever religion. I started going to church on a regular basis and I'm a completely different person, right? Mm-hmm. It's because each one of those affects the other. And who am I to tell somebody who doesn't want to go in the gym or doesn't want to do Pilates that they should? Like, do whatever you want to do. But I feel like as a healthcare practitioner, my job is to understand that all the different perspectives I can offer somebody to make them achieve what they want to achieve, mm-hmm. which comes down to the question. Sometimes I get people saying, he goes, oh, I want to do Pilates. Do you do Pilates? Can I do Pilates with you? Well, of course you can. Like, I can take you through a Pilates session. Uh-huh. But I said, do you like Pilates? Have you done Pilates? Is that something that you want to do? Or are you doing Pilates because somebody told you it's good for your core and you fixing your core will make you feel better? So at Athlete's Performance, we used to try to figure out what people's it is. You know, it's like, so why are you doing it? Mm-hmm. And running's like that too. Why do you want to get back to running? Someone's injured. Oh, when can I run again? Well, why do you want to run? Mm-hmm. Oh, I run because I like to do it for my workout. Well, okay, but what does it give to you? Like, mm-hmm. what does running make you? Like, why is that your workout? Oh, running makes me feel strong. Mm-hmm. Okay, so do other things make you feel strong? And, you know, I basically get them to realize that it's just the means to the end. Like, yeah. do you want to do Pilates? If you love Pilates because you love that apparatus, you love the movement, then do Pilates. But don't ask to do Pilates if you simply just want to feel better in your body.
Yeah.
If you want to feel better in your body, I have a million tools that I can help you with, and we'll find the right one for you. Mm-hmm. But if I don't ask why they really want to do something, then I don't, then, you know, Pilates might not be the answer. It's not, you know, it might not be somebody who's going to stick in my Pilates studio for life.
Right.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
Because I want people to feel better in their body. That's my goal.
Yeah.
And Pilates is one of the great tools that I use, but it's not the only tool.
Mm-hmm. It brings up so many interesting things that we have not gotten into before, which I'm totally loving. I was rereading one of Eric Franklin's books this morning, you know, and of course he's all about imagery and
yes.
you know, but in terms of the mind piece, right, of that mental, emotional, psychological component that, as I think many of us know, you know, is layered into our tissue. Like it's just, it's inseparable. We cannot, you know, we cannot address the body without unraveling the chemical trauma in the body, the emotional uh-huh. trauma in the body. And he's talking about flexibility, and he's talking about how, you know, working with imagery takes practice, and it's not enough to just roll and to stretch and manipulate the tissue, but you have to really start to think about your body in a different way. You have to think about,
yeah.
you know, you have to talk to it, you have to imagine it, you have to, you know, be with it, you have to move in a way that's driven by your imagination, your mind state, your emotional state, your psychological state that supports fluidity, lightness,
yes.
mobility, you know, buoyancy, resilience, like all of these things, which, you know, is of course something that I know and have worked with, but it was just, it's so, you know, he talks about it so blatantly of like,
yeah.
the practice is not just these tools that I'm giving you, in terms of movement tools, but there are all of these, you know, let's just say psychological, right? Mental tools
yeah.
that are going to make perhaps even a more profound effect and difference in your body than the act of whatever you do physically.
Absolutely. And I mean, and that's my goal, and that's kind of where the Baral Institute comes in too, is like the smartest person in the room is not me, and it's not the person's story, it's the body. And so I'm really trying to teach people how to listen to their body, to stop being floating heads, to realize that there's all this stuff attached to them and that it is just as intelligent as their brain.
Mm-hmm.
And if they get quiet enough and if they pay attention enough and they start sensing through all of their senses that they can actually hear the body talk to them. And the body does always want to be that resilient, light, free-flowing, happy, useful thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you listen to it, it will guide you in that direction. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, people don't listen to it. Mm-hmm. And so when you don't listen to it, you're trying to force it somewhere it doesn't want to be, and it fights back. And
right.
it fights back through tension, and
right.
it fights back through pain, and it fights back through, you know, crappy movement and mm-hmm. Disease and all sorts of stuff. And so, you know, that's really what my tool, every tool I give to somebody is just like Eric was saying, like, it's a tool. It's not necessarily even going to be the perfect tool for what you need, but in order to know if it is or it isn't, and we need to pick a different tool, you have to start paying attention.
Right. Yeah. And he talks a lot about that in terms of, you know, how imagery works. Like for some of us, we're very organized around our physical experience, right? We're very intelligent. We can articulate it. We can sense it. So using imagery is really not a stretch. It's not, it's,
right.
it actually feels very natural. But for a lot of people, that's not the case. And it takes practice. And what makes it work over time is that soft, focused attention of really attending to how does my body feel when I'm at dis-ease, when I'm uncomfortable, when I'm in pain, what does that really feel like? Like, what kind of discomfort is it? Where is it located? Is it only in one place? You know, like just that soft attention and focus on the body is the thing that elevates us to a, you know, a place of intelligence so that, you know, imagery and metaphor and analogy can actually work, which brings me to a couple of the things that we have talked about before, which is, a handful of things. So, we've talked a lot about internal and external cueing, and I think this, you know, starts to play into what we're going on about now. We've also talked about, how for a movement experience to stick, right, for it to take hold in the nervous system, and be planted as an implicit memory, it has to be positive, right? It has to be a positive, experience associated with that. And it was making me, when you were talking earlier about like running now, when you're running, you're totally connected to that joyful memory of running as a child.
And being the first person on the monkey bars.
Yeah. And it's like somehow you got to that point where that memory is really being revealed. It's really coming to the surface, and then that perpetuates a greater experience of like ease and efficiency and vitality in the body, right? Where the running becomes even less effortful because you're driven by that positive memory. So talk a little bit about like, how does that play out for us when we're training or when we're coaching a student? Like, how does it work and how does it not work? And
how it works is you have to have sort of a lot of tricks up your sleeve in picking different types of cues and seeing and knowing the person in front of you and seeing what works best for them. And also realizing that, understanding from a performance standpoint, the difference, you know, what internal cues and external cues do. And also, too, like what you're looking for as the clinician. Mm-hmm. So, like, you shouldn't just be talking, not paying attention or just paying attention to the movement. You want to be paying attention to their whole body. Mm-hmm. And you're wanting to notice when they have one of those positive experiences, because they might not notice it. So you might need to point it out to them.
Right.
And so when one of my athletes has one of those experiences, I stop them and I go, oh my gosh, something just felt really good, didn't it? And they're like, yeah. I go, what did it feel like? And they explain it. And I'm like, okay, do you think you could remember that? Like, if you remembered that, do you think you would be right back here? And they're like, oh yeah, absolutely. Or does that trigger another memory? And that's what I tell them. I'm like, hold on to that. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, that's what I want you to hold on to today. If that's the only thing you hold on to for our session today, is that it felt like running out at recess to the monkey bars. That's it. That's it. Because then every time you go and do that task, whether it's running or the 100, I want it to feel like that. And you're going to get your best movement pattern if they can feel that, right? And so this is, again, like assimilating information. Like, that's what, like, Deepak Chopra and, like, the Rhonda Byrne, the secret person, like, they talk about, like, manifesting things you want and being grateful, not just saying you're grateful for something, but feeling it, like feeling what it feels like to be, already get that.
Yeah.
And that's the exact same thing in movement, is like when you can really feel, like I 100% closed my eyes and I was 7 again. Like, I was a 7-year-old. Like, I know how it felt to be 7-year-old Anna running out at recess. And if I can imagine that feeling, then I go run. I don't need all the little tools I was using to recreate that same exact movement pattern. I just need to hold on to that feeling.
Yeah.
And when you are in that feeling, you are really present and things go well.
And you do that.
And I think Eric, so where I first started playing around with that is, you know, Eric Franklin said, you know, look for the kinesthetic experience, like yes. look for the kinesthetic change.
Yes.
Like always looking for that. And as soon as I get that, that I know that's the either the type of cue that they love or that I got a positive emotion with it.
Yeah.
And so I know then it will stick.
Yeah. And it gets stored, right? I mean, it's not like...
Yes, it gets stored. So it's more likely in the parts of the brain that store motor patterns, when you look at the research, if there is an emotion, especially a positive emotion associated with a movement experience, that movement experience is automatically banked in the piggy bank, saved forever. If you don't have a positive emotion with it, if it's just like, if I was like, okay, in order to run, I want you to have your pelvis forward and, you know, dorsiflex your feet and land right behind the metatarsals and, you know, keep your chest up and breathe this way and breathe through your nose. And, you know, if I give them a bunch of rules and they still get a good movement experience, like a good movement pattern out of it,
right?
In order for that to stick to the next day of training, they need to have a, like the most perfect day afterwards, like no stress, perfect nutrition, no alcohol, great hydration, you know, 8 to 10 hours of sleep within the proper circadian rhythm time, right before midnight, you're right. In order, that's really what needs to happen for our brain to store it in the right spot for it to become a memory or like a movement memory.
Right.
And so if that doesn't happen, I love Nick Winkelman is the person that speaks on this quite a bit. And I love his analogy. He's like, if that doesn't happen, they come in the next day to train with you. And it's like, yesterday didn't exist.
Yes.
It's like the men in black came up with their pen and they snapped it in front of their face and they forgot everything.
Yeah.
And so, and you're like thinking to yourself as the teacher or the clinician, you're like, what the heck? Like how you did this perfectly yesterday. And they're looking at you like the cues you're giving them are completely foreign. Like they don't even know where their pelvis is anymore.
Yeah. And we've all had
and
that
you're
experience.
Like, yeah, we've all experienced that. I'm like, really? We went over all the anatomy of your pelvis yesterday.
Yeah.
You really can't point out where your pubic bone is now? Like, really? And that's why. Because you gave them a lot of internal cues, which are really good for creating awareness. Understand that we're not a floating head.
Right.
But they're not really good for performance. And they're not really good for repeated performance of big movements.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that for a second. So when we're talking about internal cueing, we're talking about trying to get something to happen or sense something happening from inside of us, right? It's like having an introspective experience, a felt experience of the body and moving from within us, right? And
within us, like, yeah, it can be like inside or it can be simply like when we're talking about hip extension, right? Like, it can be like move your hip behind you, like extend your leg behind you.
Right. So the body like, relating internal. To itself.
Yeah.
Right.
And external would be like push the ground away behind you.
And we have talked about, so then the body relating to the external situation, right? To the external environment. Right.
So, right.
Okay. So, and what we have talked about, you know, because you have over the years been so focused on performance, that the further away the cue, the external cue, the greater the effort, right? The greater the exertion.
Well, in terms of for your novice or master person, so like if I'm teaching someone how to hit a golf ball, and they've never hit a golf ball before, I would want to use an external cue that's closer to them. If we're talking to a professional golfer who has golfed their whole life and I'm trying to improve their swing, I'm going to give them a farther away cue.
Right.
So something down towards the pin or, you know, a tree in the distance or something like that. Whereas the novice athlete, I would cue the golf club.
Yes.
The reason why I wouldn't cue the golf club and the golfer, and so why a farther distance works for master athletes, is because of the neural mapping that occurs for people, right? Like, you have a golf club in your hand long enough, and it's mapped in your brain.
Yes, right.
So then the golf club is effectively and actually an internal cue for that golfer. Whereas it's an external cue for me who never golfs. So that's part of the reason why you have to know who you're speaking to. Like, what's their, you know, in the strength and conditioning, industry, and we would call it like their training age. What's their training age with Pilates, or what's their training age with golf? Are they young or are they old? And if they're old, then your external cues should have some distance to them. So like a Pilates, someone who's been doing Pilates for life, the reformer is mapped in their brain. And so when you tell them in like leg work to press the foot bar away, you're giving them an internal cue.
Got it.
Because the reformer is mapped to them. So you would want to say press the wall away, or press the, you know, car away if they're facing the parking lot.
Right.
You know.
Right. So one of the things that I think we have touched on before too is, which feels like it's relevant to a couple of different points that we've talked about today so far, which is when you over cue or over teach, right? You're giving either a lot of internal cueing without any external cueing, or you're overcomplicating a movement, so it's broken down into too many separate pieces, or you're not really tuning into that, you know, that positive mental emotional experience. It's like it becomes too much to integrate, right? It becomes too much to hold.
Yeah, I mean, it's literally too much for them to think about.
Yeah.
Like, we only have a certain amount of attention capacity.
Right.
And so when you give them too much information, even if it's good information, they, like, stop
listening.
Stop getting anything. They stop listening. They stop participating. They stop listening. They don't pick anything up because – and then nothing gets stored, even if it was pretty good, right? Because their capacity was just overmaxed.
Right.
And that capacity – again, improves over time. Novices are going to have a smaller capacity of attention than masters, but still, you don't want to totally take up all their space.
Right.
Right? Just like our iPhones. You don't want to put too many videos for your kids on there, because then you're not going to have any video room for work stuff.
That's right. That's right. So how does this all relate to what we were just about to talk about earlier, which is about working from the muscle, training the muscle versus something else?
Training movement or muscle. So my first sort of experience in how maybe cueing the muscles wasn't a good idea was with Eric Franklin's work, when he talks about the importance of cueing the bones, because when you cue a muscle, our brain only knows one way of what it feels like to contract a muscle, and that's a concentric contraction.
Right.
And concentric contractions, you know, they amp up really quickly and they create a lot of tension. And if you have a lot of tension, you're not moving.
Right.
And a concentric contraction is also what happens to the muscle when it's protecting something. So, you know, it was just kind of like a trigger point. And so you see that a lot with people that are in pain and disease and injury and that kind of things. And so I'd already been kind of thinking about it a lot. And so I had already kind of moved away from cueing a lot of the muscles and telling somebody to contract their core or TA or pelvic floor, just from that standpoint of like, well, why would I want to bind up the joints, bind up the bones from moving? Well, that's what I'm trying to do, is get them to move through these joints that they're not used to moving through. And so then again, with the Baral Institute, one of the first classes I took, the teacher said, Jean-Pierre says that the muscles are the garbage can of the body. At the time, I don't think I realized, like, how much it offended me. It's not until now that I'm more accepting of it and I agree with them that I realize how offended I really was. But it makes sense that I was, because for my entire life, my entire professional life, at least, I've been obsessed with the muscles and thinking that the muscles had everything to do with anything. Like, that everybody had glute amnesia, that everybody needed to squeeze their glutes. The key to happiness and the key to feeling good was to squeeze your glutes and tighten up your core.
Right.
And so it's like, yeah, that was like my religion for many, many years. And somebody just flat out told me it was the garbage can. And I was like, okay, yeah, whatever. And I try to like be very open when I'm learning things. And if the person teaching me says something I don't like, I don't completely brush them off.
Right.
Like, I feel like I'm sure, well, I know I totally offend people when I not offend them in like a Donald Trump sort of way, but like offend them in like I challenge some very deep held beliefs within their head. And I think that's like, I love it when that happens. Like if I teach a course and I haven't challenged some deep beliefs in people, then I don't feel like I did a very good job.
Yeah.
And on the flip side, when I get asked questions at the end of a course or during a course and they don't challenge my, like they don't challenge what I just told them, I also feel like I didn't do a good job because just because I'm sharing it and this is what I believe right now, it doesn't mean it's true.
Right.
You know, and I'm probably wrong. I mean, even though I love to hear the words, you're right, I'm probably wrong and I'm okay with that. Because being wrong is easy to fix, right? You learn a different way. You understand that that was the more correct way, and you move on with your life. Mm-hmm. The problem is when you are holding on to beliefs so much that you will never admit that you could be wrong, and right. And you won't let go. Right. And so when they told me the muscles are the garbage can of the body, I was like, I don't like that, but I'll listen to you. And then the more and more I practiced their work, their manual therapy, the work, the more I realized, as I treat the organs, and, you know, the organs are easy to think about in the trunk, right? Liver, kidney, stomach, anything. But the organs in the periphery, we don't often think of organs, even though they are. And those are the nerves and the arteries and the veins, the little capillaries, the lymph, all of those vessels that are running through our arms and legs. When I free up space around them and allow them to glide better and allow the flow of their fluid to move better, the muscles that appeared to be short or stiff, tight or trigger pointed, however you would like to refer to it, are not actually like that. They completely let go as soon as the organs are not in a position to be injured. As soon as the nerves, the vessels, the vasculature are free to move in free-flowing fluid, everything lets go, and then you move well. And when the muscles are not all bound up, guess what? The joints, you actually move better in the joints.
Right.
And then now they have a good movement experience, and then it's stored, and now it's like, well, that was easy. I feel sometimes, well, I always tell people, like, sometimes it's a really quick thing. Like, I sometimes will treat, especially with athletes, because they're quick at everything, I sometimes treat them once for, like, I had this football player the other day. He had toe pain for 4 weeks, hadn't played. I treated him one session. He played the next day, and then in the game on that Sunday. And so it's like, they're like, oh, my God, it's magic. No, it's not magic. I freed up the thing that was the most important. We got better blood flow to it. And then the body didn't have to protect it anymore. So it said, okay, knock yourself out. Go play. Okay. Have as much fun as you want. And so it's like, okay, the more and more I listen to someone's body and really find the structure that it is protecting, or really get them out of the protection mode, get them into the rest and digest mode, and get them to learn how to flip back and forth on their own, like have it in balance, right? Balance their autonomic nervous system. The more profound the effects are, and the more I never touch the muscles, and I never tell them to activate a muscle or squeeze something or relax something or anything. I just, like, literally, it can be as boring, the most boring external or internal cue in the world of, like, move your arm here. You're like here, and then the movement is just good.
Yeah. So basically, you're saying that the muscle becomes the block. It blocks efficient movement from happening because it's protecting.
Because it's protecting. Organs. Because it's protecting something. Uh-huh. And you're not listening to the body to find out what it's protecting. Uh-huh. And the muscle's like, oh my gosh, I'm smarter than you. You can do anything you want to get me to turn on or turn off. But as soon as you walk away, as soon as I have a chance to go back to what I was doing, I'm going to go back to what I'm doing.
Right, right.
Which is why it feels like banging your head against the wall when you're trying to improve mobility sometimes in people.
Yeah.
Because if you're not actually fixing the thing that they're having trouble compensating for, then the body is always going to go back to protect it.
Right. Right.
That's what makes us so amazing, is like our body actually will take care of itself or protect itself. And so do you have tools to help it, or are you fighting it? Mm-hmm. And it's like, I feel like with a lot of the deep tissue work people do, and the painful stretching and a lot of the painful modalities people think that they need to do in order to feel better.
Yeah.
I actually think you're fighting the body. Mm-hmm. And yeah, eventually it gives up. Because it's like, okay, a friend of mine loves, I always give HR analogies, which is strange since I've never worked in HR, but I'm like, think about it. Like, if you have somebody in your office complaining all the time, you have three options. You can completely ignore them. That's an option.
Okay.
You can listen to them and try to address the problem. The real problem, or you could just beat the crap out of them and tell them fuck it all.
Yeah.
And all right, like if you beat the crap out of them and they can't talk at all, like, man, the office is a great place to be for the rest of the day. Uh-huh. But then 2 days later, when they come to, they're talking again, and they're maybe even talking a little bit louder. Or you're just like, have a little bit shorter fuse with them, right? Because you're like, oh my God, I thought we talked about this. Right?
So funny.
And right. But, and that's how it is. So it's like, okay, is the deep tissue, is it beating the crap out of something that's trying to protect you? Or is it really doing are you doing what you think you're doing when you apply a modality or an exercise?
Right. So let's talk about how this is can be relevant for people who are not doing hands-on manipulation. And the two things I'm thinking of are cueing from the bones instead of the muscles as one option. And then working with some of the fascial-oriented training principles, you know, priming the body, preparing the body, so that there is clearer communication, more open system communication, triggers the parasympathetic nervous system, like all of those things that we can do with something like like through the mount method or through some of the ball rolling work.
The Franklin worker. I'm not totally against massage or, and I'm not even totally against deep tissue. It's just, I'm against deep tissue over and over in the same spot with no results.
Yes, right. Yeah. Well, I mean, it would be the same of like, let's do the 100 again, and it looks like crap, and it hurts your neck, and it hurts your hip flexors.
But let's just keep doing
Right.
Because it's supposed to help you. Yeah, and then I guess the other thing, you know, within this that I sort of have switched to from the Baral Institute and from realizing, like, the body is probably the smart one, not me, is, stop fighting against it. Mm-hmm. If something you're doing creates tension or creates a feeling of apprehension, or if someone's breathing pattern changes or the look on their face changes, you're going in the wrong direction. The body usually likes to go in the direction of least resistance first,
right?
Sort of warm itself up, get the joint fluids going, get the proprioceptors turned on. And then if you try the other direction, now it will go there a little bit more freely.
Right.
And that's the Baral Institute thing. Like the majority of their treatments, the manual therapy treatments, are through a technique called induction, which is basically you load the tissue, you back off, and then you follow where it goes. Uh-huh. So you're listening to you're listening to the body, and the body says, hey, what if we go over here first? What if we rotate to the right first, even though I need more left rotation? If I rotate to the right, and then I actually side bend to the right, and I go into a little extension, as soon as I take a deep breath, I go right over to left rotation and more left rotation than I had before.
Yeah.
And so it's just a different approach. Most of the time we've been taught, okay, you're limited in left rotation. Let's stretch the crap of left rotation.
Yeah.
And let's not address right rotation at all because it's not the problem.
Right. Yes. Right. And my feeling always was too, that the side that's harmonious, you know, we'll just call it a side, was going to be able to teach us so much more than starting with the side that's impaired. And then trying to use your analogy, like beat it into submission. It also, what else? I was just thinking about something else that I was kind of chuckling in my head about, but of course, it probably wouldn't have been as funny, so I've promptly forgotten it.
Okay.
So moving from the bones and doing some of this, like, well, even to bring us back to, okay, so the Franklin work, soft focused attention, you know, the rolling, the manual therapy, self-manual therapy, self-massage, you know, done mindfully and appropriately, all really beneficial so that we're not just playing into the garbage cans, right? We're not just being totally stymied and held hostage by how the muscles are behaving.
Right.
I was thinking about, okay, so this idea of moving in the path of least resistance, I hope I'm going to be able to pull two ideas together here, but we'll see. There's also something that I talk a lot about, which is, I teach from this framework called motivational interviewing, which was developed for the rehabilitation setting. And it's a whole framework for coaching and supporting you know, addicts in recovery. And one of the components, so the components are like appropriate, genuine empathy coaching. So appropriate empathy, discrepancy, like you said early on, like if somebody's having a positive experience, sometimes we need to point that out because,
you know, because they may not notice it.
They may not notice it. And that develops discrepancy. It's like, look, when you did this before this way, you were hating it. Now we've done it a new way and you're totally in love with it. So, but another component is what they call rolling with resistance. And this is about the mental, emotional resistance. This makes me think of like the same is true. We've been drawing all these parallels between, you know, the emotional, let's call it the subtle body or the emotional body and the physical body. But it's, you know, it's like, it's this, it's like all playing in together, right? Supporting and promoting positive, positive connotations with movement experiences, you know, moving in the path of least resistance. That to me is always also a reflection of like, let's have a positive experience. Let's not just start out by focusing on what's wrong with you. You know, it's like, it's why I've always had it. It's why I've never wanted to go into the therapeutic realm of, teaching.
Right. Cause they love finding out what's wrong with you.
Yeah. Well, it's because, you know, like if I go in with SI joint pain, what I know is probably going to happen is we're going to talk about my dysfunctional SI joint for the next 10 sessions. And basically I'm not into it. I have no interest in being, I'm going to say victim of that. That's a little bit strong, but,
it is. I mean, but I like, that's like, how sad is that? Like somebody wants, like has made the choice to feel better and has come to you for help. And the first thing you did is point out everything that was wrong with them. And I am 100% guilty of that. And the first athlete, I had a professional hockey athlete at one day that pointed it out to me and I was like, wow, I've never really thought about it that way.
Yeah.
And you're right. Because he's like, Anna, like, honestly, he's like, I know that you're supposed to be good and be able to help me. He's like, but I felt good and I was just coming to you to sort of like improve my performance and feel better. And you basically told me that I don't breathe correctly and I can't walk correctly. And I'm like lucky to, like, I'm lucky to be even like upright, let alone playing hockey. And I was like, oh. And then you know what? He never came back to work with me, and I don't blame him. I wouldn't have wanted to work with me either.
Yeah. Well, I think
I am so grateful for his comments. Like so wonderful that he felt comfortable enough with me to share that because I was like, huh. Okay, I see your point. Maybe I should like not be so blatantly everything's wrong with you to try to get you to want to work with me.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a better way. And then I took a webinar from Thomas Myers, and he said that too. Like, before you tell somebody what's wrong with them, how about you point out 5 good things about them?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, this just plays into all of the things we've been talking about too, which is, you know, like, creating that positive experience and not being attached to the perfect movement outcome. We all have different levels of potential. So the other thing, the thing that you and I have talked about in the past is just this idea of awareness. And you do that. I just interviewed a teacher, a local teacher, James Crater, who is really exceptional at this too. But it's about asking questions, and there's so much value in asking questions. You know, you've mentioned so far how you ask questions to connect with the person's like positive history of moving, or you're asking questions to like, okay, I noticed a shift in you. What was that about? What did it feel like? How was it, you know, how was it good? Why did it feel easy? Like, I need to know more about that so we can do more of that.
Right.
So this is a very different piece, right?
It is. I mean, especially sometimes in the Pilates world too, with it being such a dance background of like having the person say something. Like, I don't know, I only did dance for so long, but it was like, I was afraid of my teacher. I couldn't talk. I couldn't say anything. And so like allowing an environment for conversation and for them to trust you enough to tell you what feels good and what doesn't feel good, and give you a little bit of a history and know it's okay to speak up whenever they want to is like so important and so valuable, because like I said, their body is the thing that's the most intelligent in the room, not you.
Yeah.
Their body is going to be what fixes them, not you. And so like, if you don't create an environment that is you asking authentic, genuine questions and like listening, like not just asking questions, but like being there and listening and being okay with, sometimes that means you don't get very much stuff done.
Right.
Then so be it. Like, yeah.
Well, to me too, it's like asking questions. It not only gives me information, but it allows the student to become more aware of their own mind state or their own relationship to their pain or their own relationship to their motivation. You know, it's like, well, you know, like, what, you know, tell me the most positive movement experience you've had in the last 24 hours. Or tell me one of the happiest memories in terms of movement or sports, you know, from your childhood. It's like all of these probing questions that I think we're often afraid to ask because we think it's outside of our scope. Could potentially be the most important pieces of our coaching and our training. So I just think that's so interesting. I mean, this is a piece that I've been working on a lot for a couple of reasons. And it's the reason why it's come up in our conversations, collaborating with my colleague Ann Bishop on the master level program that we're getting ready to start, which is the science and psychology of teaching, which is really exciting. And so we've been integrating a lot of this idea of how do we assess a person's emotional orientation to their body or their movement experience, you know, just working with the mind state a little bit more overtly than I think most teachers are comfortable with. And then been working with Joseph Quinn, who I just interviewed, who's the founder of Pilates Metrics, which is getting ready. It's an app, an iPad app that's getting ready to launch, in developing a library of quote unquote exercises. And I have built in this piece called Off the Mat. And Off the Mat is not, it's not exercises at all. It's not movement.
Right.
It's questions. It's awareness prompts, right? It's like trying to get the student to dig a little deeper. And also for me to assess where they are in terms of, you know, motivation and personal responsibility and, you know, how all of that is shifting, because it feels like it's connected, right? I think is the bottom line of what we've discussed.
Oh, absolutely.
So far.
So, yeah, the whole point of our today's topic, like, yeah, everything's connected.
Yeah, it's good stuff, I think, is the bottom line. And as I said in the beginning of our conversation, I have always really appreciated this, you know, this kind of perspective that you offer of like not making a rule of things and looking at things from a variety of perspectives. And I think it's important that we're doing that. You know, this audience, the people who are listening, are primarily Pilates teachers, but also yoga teachers and massage therapists and other things. I think it's good to get us to think outside of the box and begin to maybe see that we're doing something way bigger than just training bodies.
Right.
We're doing something way more than just trying to achieve perfect movement patterns and, you know, yes. greater flexibility.
And like, what an honor is it, you know, like to be able to be that person for somebody. Is
yeah.
Like...
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it has been a fantastic conversation. I had no doubt that it would be, and we've covered a lot of ground. Is there anything else you want to add before we wrap up?
I don't think so. I mean, it's a pleasure to talk, and it's like whenever I do podcasts or speak, I'm just grateful for everybody listening and interested, and I love talking shop, if you will, and you know, I like I said earlier, I don't think I know everything, and everything I do is the right way, and I'm just constantly, my friend Koichi calls it a truth seeker, like X-Files, so, you know, I don't know if the truth is out there, but I definitely think it's really fun to play around and get to experience different sort of science projects within each person's body, and I'm the first science project I do for every new thing. So mm-hmm. it's fun, and it's to connect with people who have the same views.
Yeah.
In that sense. Yeah.
Yes. Right. So just a last few things, about Anna. Anna is also the founder of Movement Rev, which is her business in Arizona. Check her out at movementrev.com. And then Anna is going to be presenting at the PMA conference in just a few weeks. So if you're headed that way, you should check it out and connect with her on Facebook. She has a Facebook page for Movement Rev. And I think that's it. I love you, Darlene, and I'm looking forward
love
to seeing
too.
You. And thank you again for just the crazy, awesome, always nerding out.
It is never
disappointing. Well, thanks so much. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Sounds good.
Bye-bye.
You're a mystery to me, and I'm not asking for the key, but I hope that you let me in the door.